I'm Joel Vaughn. This is my wife, Pat. We've been talking about Who Am I Anyway? This is the fourth in a series, three of which are on tape, and today we're going to be talking about Who Am I in relation to myself? I'm sorry, Who Am I in relation to my children or to children? How many of you here have children?
What is a child?
Well, you're gonna get difficult right in the beginning. Huh? How many of you here have been children? Oh, very good. That's good. And then yes, next you're anticipating my next question. How many of you still are children? Okay, very good. I ask those those questions for a couple of reasons. One is I want to talk with you today a little bit about who am I in relation to myself from the point of view of our relationship to our children or to children, and from the point of view of their relationship to us. So it kind of goes both ways. And I want to cover some remarks that I found, and I can't remember exactly the publication I found them in, but it was, they're by a psychologist by the name of Michael Cavanaugh. I think from the West Coast, as a matter of fact, and was in a, pardon me?
He's from San Diego.
Oh, from San Diego? Okay. Maybe you can help me. It was, I thought it was in Marriage and the Family. Are any of you familiar with Marriage and the Family, a periodical published in, I'm really blocking that today, a periodical published in the Midwest.
Abbey Press.
It is an Abbey Press.
Right.
That's it, Minert, Minnesota. That's where it is. And I believe it's an, sponsored by the Catholic Church, but it's a very unique kind of periodical in that it talks a good deal about Christian families, Christian relationships, Christian marriage and family kinds of problems. And I think it was there that I saw this article, and I liked it so much that I'd like to really kind of go over it with you today and talk a little bit about expectations. I mean, we talked the first night, the first afternoon, a little bit about our expectations for other people, our expectations for ourselves. And Pat, in her thing that she had on the board here, talked a little bit about how our self-concept is formed by not only what we expect ourselves, but probably comes most out of what others expect of us, especially what parents expect of us. And just another sidelight, in my work as a psychologist, I think I've been impressed over and over again by the ways in which we are shaped, both positively and negatively, by the kinds of expectations that are communicated to us very early in life, and really throughout life, especially throughout our formative years or our childhood years. That's why I wanted to make sure all of you had once been children, because I wanted to speak to some of the expectations that that probably you carry around with you for yourself, as well as some of those that you pass on to your own children. Format for today is pretty much my talking at you for about 30 minutes, I hope, no more, and then our talking together, you're talking back at us, and that's what I'd like to do it today. Cavanaugh points out that there are two kinds of conflicts that occur in all families. The first kind of a conflict is, the two conflicts are unavoidable and avoidable, and he gives an interesting example of an unavoidable conflict. An unavoidable conflict, according to him, would be five people in a home with only one bathroom. That's an unavoidable conflict. And any of you who have ever lived in that kind of situation know that there are unavoidable situations that come up in every family that give us great difficulty and that cause problems. The vast majority of problems that we have, however, with other people are avoidable in that they are based on poor communication or a poor understanding of one another. Most avoidable conflicts, according to Cavanaugh, stem from unrealistic expectations. And that's where I really would dovetail with a good deal of his thinking. Unrealistic expectations, the kind of things we want for others, that we want for ourselves, that we expect for them, get us into a great deal of trouble. Kavanaugh points out that expectations are likely to be unrealistic for one of three basic reasons. The first reason would be that a level of maturity is expected which is simply impossible. A level of immaturity. I always, at this point, and in talking about unrealistic expectations, talk about a story that I tell on myself, because I think it fits beautifully, unrealistic expectations or a level of maturity that's just impossible. When our oldest daughter was, 7 or 8 years of age, it was a Sunday afternoon, I was working in the yard doing something, and she came by and said, I wanted to have dinner with the neighbors down the street. And I said, sure, that's fine. She went off to have Sunday dinner with the neighbors and came back about 3 hours later. And I was still out in the yard. Maybe that's why I reacted the way I did. But she came back and said, hi, I'm back home. And it was at that point that I noticed that she didn't have any shoes on. And I said to her in my most fatherly tone, do you mean to tell me that you went down to have dinner with the Kennedys without your shoes? And her feet were just dirty, just, you know, that kind of built-in grime that kids who run around without any shoes get on their feet. And she said, yeah, she did that as if that were not such a terrible crime as I was making it out to be. And then I really lost my temper, and I felt I just really upset with her for that, and I said, well, that's a terrible thing to do, that, you know, you went down there with dirty feet and had Sunday dinner with the neighbor. What are the neighbors going to think of me and our family if we go down and have dinner with them with dirty feet? And I said, well, you did that, and that's wrong, or something to that effect, and you go to your room, and you stay there till you can learn to act like an adult. That was standing there watching me work in the yard. Maybe that's why I was mad, too. You were standing there watching me work in the yard instead of working with me. And she just kind of shook her head, you know, and looked at me like I was from another planet, because I was, my best psychological manner there had sent her to her room till she was an adult. She still stays in her room, by the way. She's 16 now. We feed her under the door. And in a couple of years, she'll be eligible for parole from her room because she'll be an adult. But that's the kind of thing that slips out, but I think it's the kind of thing that many times characterizes our relationship with our children, that we expect from them something that we expect from ourselves or that we think they ought to be able to do, but that's really very unrealistic. At that age, to be concerned about whether her feet had shoes on or whether they were clean or not when she was invited to dinner, and the Kennedys never said anything to us. They were good friends after that, and they didn't have a big problem with the fact she didn't have any shoes on. But that was a big problem for me because of, I don't really know why that was such a big problem for me, but that's the kind of thing I think we do to our kids. The other thing that happens with expectations is that our expectation is often for ideal behavior. We want our children, or children often, but primarily our children, I think, to do exactly what should be done. And ideal behavior, unfortunately, is the exception rather than the rule with people. One of the little sayings we have in our house is, it needs a little more salt, is it needs a little more salt. Now, we use that for a variety of reasons. Mostly because, I guess, again, it comes from me coming home and checking out what's for dinner and always thinking that it could use a pinch of this or a pinch of that, always looking for that little extra thing that's needed to make it just right. And now, because we do that, or because I do that maybe so often, and I don't know, I won't speak for Pat, but because we have that tendency to do that kind of thing, we use it as a little bit of a joke. Sometimes when things aren't right or when we want them to be just a little bit better, we'll often say it needs just a little more salt. Our tendency as people many times to want things to be just right, to expect that they're going to be perfect, to expect that we're going to be perfect, to expect that behavior is going to be perfect, and that nobody's ever going to make a mistake. And the third reason why expectations can be unrealistic is because expectations ask that, or when expectations ask that an individual behave in a way that would be detrimental to his or her growth, so that if we, for example, have an expectation that our adolescent children will do everything that we ask them to do, and that they will always do things the way we want them to do, and that they will follow exactly what we expect of them, that is really an expectation that's unrealistic, primarily because it's detrimental to their growth. You cannot have a healthy, functioning adolescent who is growing into a young adult and to an adult in their own right who does everything that somebody else tells them to do, or who follows exactly what their parents expect of them. So that when we put that kind of expectation, and when we operate in our families in a way that suggests that's the way things have to be, the expectations become unrealistic. Okay, so that many of the expectations that we have for each other in a relationship, many of the expectations we have for our children are realistic, but I want to deal today with primarily unrealistic expectations. And I want to deal with it from the point of view of the expectations we have as parents for our children and some of the expectations that children have for us as parents, because it does work both ways. One of the expectations, and there are three basic ones I want to cover with you in each category, but as a parent, we expect that children should always be sensitive to the needs and feelings of others in the family. We expect that they should be able to be caring. We expect many times that they should be able to get along with their brothers or sisters. We expect that they should be able to do the things that really come out of an unrealistic expectation for their level of maturity. We expect them to be sensitive, and yet children, by their very nature, do not have the kind of sensitivity that many adults might have. Of course, many adults don't have that sensitivity either. For example, a 10-year-old tells her sister she's fat, and her sister responds with, "Yeah, but at least I'm not stupid." You know, we get upset at those kinds of comments because they don't reflect the kind of sensitivity from either direction. Or we get upset sometimes when a younger child won't share with another child. Or we get upset when kids come and bother Dad when he's reading the paper and has had a hard day, or that kids constantly come in the house to interrupt adults in the process of their conversation. It's not that we shouldn't basically expect that children would observe certain kinds of manners, but at the same time we have to keep in mind that sensitivity in children is something that's learned and that grows over a period of time and that one is not born with, just as is true with adults. And that insensitivity in children occurs because of a couple of factors. One, sensitivity has to do with a kind of neurological development and a kind of cognitive sophistication that only comes when someone is more mature and older. And secondly, we often display insensitivity to our own children and as a result teach them not to be sensitive, that they learn from us. They learn from us in positive ways, but they learn from us in negative ways as well. Second expectation I think we often have of children is that children shouldn't fight or argue. Actually, some degree of fighting, some degree of conflict, some degree of argument is extremely healthy for children, just as it is for us as adults. that there are many, many situations on a daily basis that arise that cause difficulties in our relationships with others. Those we have to learn somehow how to deal with those. One of the ways children learn how to deal with conflict is by arguing and fighting with one another. Several things are learned in that situation. One, the way in which we would express feelings is learned in an argument. Two, the way in which we give in to other people is learned in an argument. And also the ability to tolerate tension is learned in an argument. Children who come out of homes where there is no conflict, and I don't believe those probably exist very much, or that I haven't seen them, but children who would come out of that environment where they never see parents get upset with one another, where they never have any kind of witness of difficulty or conflict, don't really learn how to deal with it very well. The way in which we as parents fight, of course, serves as an example for our children. Sometimes that can be a very negative example. This is not to say that parents should fight in any way in front of their children, because as we know that there are many destructive ways of fighting. There are many physically and emotionally abusive ways of hurting one another. And if we teach our children that through example, they learn to fight in the same manner. On the other hand, parents who never fight, parents who only get quiet when they're angry, parents who pout for 2 or 3 days when they're upset about something, teach their children something else. They teach their children a way of dealing passively but aggressively with those kinds of problems in their own situation. Parents who never give in, parents who never apologize, parents who never reconcile in front of children don't teach their children very effective ways of managing those conflicts either. So that to expect the children would never fight, or to expect the children would not argue or fight in a number of different ways is unrealistic as well. The third, and really the crusher here, and that gets to the heart of expectations, is that children, we expect unrealistically, that children should assume the same values that we have. This is really a conflict for us because we believe, oftentimes, especially if we've been relatively successful in our lives, we believe that we have found the way to be successful. We believe that we have found the way to do things correctly. And we want, I think, probably out of the best interest for our children, we want to share that with them. We want to show them how to do that. The problem comes in when we expect that they will follow to the letter the kinds of values, the kinds of behaviors, the kinds of attitudes, and the kind of outlook that we have. This is especially a cause of conflict between adolescents and parents. A great part of the problems that I see in a clinical setting between parents and adolescents is around the notion of values. You're not behaving the way I want you to behave. You're not doing the things that I want you to do. You become very different, you become very negative, you are looking for other kinds of experiences that are against what our family stands for. Kavanaugh does, I think, justice to this topic by pointing out that there are really basically two kinds of values, and that while we might expect that a child or our children would follow us in the what he calls the primary values, that there are many other secondary values that we also expect allegiance from them in, and that's where we get into trouble. He talks about the primary values as loving ourselves and loving others, or being honest with ourselves and others, or being just with ourselves and others. The broader concepts of behavior and life in a world being the primary values. But then he talks about a lot of secondary values like success, education, work, loyalty, prestige, obedience, respect, patriotism, lots of other secondary values that come out of those primary values, but that many times our kids need to find their own way in. Not many times, almost always need to find their own way in. that we can present and hopefully demonstrate by the way in which we live our lives the values that we would like them to take, but that we can't ever make them assume a certain kind of value. And it's that power struggle that parents get into, especially with adolescents and young adults, that causes a great deal of difficulty. He points out, too, that any or all of these secondary values may be virtuous or unvirtuous, depending on how much growth or damage results from them. So that, for example, they may be virtuous to a point, but then they can become a liability, i.e. work. The work ethic is a very effective one for certain kinds of success, but taken to the extreme, we talk about workaholics, or we talk about people who can't do anything but work. A lot of the conflict between many young people today and people of a somewhat earlier generation is around this issue of work and what kind of work is important and how do you work and how do you find other ways to experience yourself and to experience life beside just working and saving money and building up resources that a lot of us who came out of an earlier time feel is very important to accumulate as a kind of security. You talk with parents who were parents or who lived during the Depression, of course, and we see that kind of Depression ethic, that it's extremely important to save your money. You never know when the next problem is going to occur, when the next part of our society is going to collapse. I remember when I started out as a clinical psychologist, I had a chief psychologist in my internship setting who suggested that I stay in the state hospital system, which at that point, from my point of view, was a total dead-end kind of situation. And if I had followed that, I think I'd have been terribly unhappy. Luckily, I was able to kind of go on from there. But his rationale and the reason he was there was when the next depression comes, this will be a good place to be. It'll be safe here. You know, there'll always be certain kinds of jobs here that'll be protected. It wasn't a question of if the next depression comes. It was when the next depression comes. And too often, those kinds of expectations on our part are the kinds of things that we transmit to our kids that they don't see. But they're not coming at it from the same perspective at all. And my reaction to him was much like what maybe my children's reaction to me will be in certain other areas. And I just couldn't believe that he had that attitude. And yet, it was very much a part of his experience and a part of what we, I suppose, now commonly call the generation gap. Secondary values often are time-related as well. For example, the role of women is a time-related value. If we were raised 30 years ago by our mother, as a woman, by our mother, who was raised 30 years before that, how does that role of woman speak to a young woman today at age 18 or 19? Things are very different. Attitudes are very different. Society is very different. And when we are stuck too far back in certain attitudes and feelings that we feel are inviolable and have to be adopted, we put that young person in a very difficult position because they're in a position of wanting to be their own person and needing to live in the world today and with the patterns of today's world and the roles of today's world, and yet wanting to please as well. And that's can be a very untenable kind of conflict. So the conflicts arise in families when parents fail to distinguish between primary and secondary values and lump them all together because both are instrumental in our happiness or success. We often want children to internalize our primary and secondary values, as I said. We want our kids to be obedient for obedience' sake. We want them to dress in certain ways. We want them to go to college. We want them to pursue a particular career many times. We want them to have prestige. We want them to be successful. We want them to earn money. The list goes on and on. We don't all share the same ones, but you could probably sit down and if you thought about your own consciousness in terms of how you see your family, what you want for them, there are a number of things that you'd like for those kids to be able to do. The problem is, you see, that they may not want that for themselves. And that's where we often come into conflict. Okay, what are the expectations that children have for us as parents? I'll go through this quickly so we have some time for discussion. As a child, children expect, one, that parents should be perfect. Why do they expect that? Why do children expect that we should be perfect?
We told them so.
Well, we did in some ways, I think. You're right. By our behavior and our actions, we many times tell them so. Why else? Why else do children expect that? Why would children expect their parents to be perfect? Well, from a child's perspective, when you're looking at an adult, it looks perfect. You know, when children are young, they idolize their parents typically. Even, it's very interesting and very, very pathetic kind of observation that the children who are abused when they're young, physically abused or emotionally abused, still are very, very attached to their parents and often feel that the parents are not wrong in doing that to them. That feeling, by the way, often stays into adulthood. I've talked with many adults in therapy, worked with many adults in therapy who were abused as children. And the struggle that they have is, what must I have done to make my father beat me in the way he did? What was wrong with me? Instead of being able to see, and sometimes through psychotherapy and counseling can come to that insight, but instead of being able to see that there was something wrong with Dad, there was something wrong with the family, there was something wrong with Mother in the way that she treated me. But typically the feeling is still, I did something wrong, because at that age, the feeling is that adult knows exactly what to do and knows exactly how to do it and is doing everything right. Now, when kids get a little bit older, especially, again, when they get into adolescence, they begin to point out the ways in which we're doing things wrong. And they find all kinds of things that we're doing wrong, many of which are just ways to kind of get us ruffled. But they begin to see us more realistically. But one of the reasons why kids expect that their parents should be perfect is simply because, from their perspective, it looks that way. The other reason, though, is that we tell them that, and we also tell them that another way. We expect them to be perfect. When we put expectations on them, they tend to do the same thing with other people. They put those expectations on themselves, and they put them on us as well. They expect many times that we should dedicate our lives to them. I don't know if you get this point with your children, but many times kids will say, you know, they'll say, well, I'd like you to, or would you do this for me? I'm trying to think of a specific example. I can't, but something like, would you do this for me? And you say, well, no, I can't do that now. I've got to go over and do this thing. And if you scratch the surface a little bit and you really try to find out, and they get upset by that, and if you try to really find out why they're upset about the fact that you're not going to be able to do something for them as they want, you'll often hear them say, well, you had me, didn't you? You know, you're supposed to do that. Many times kids will, underneath, really basically kind of feel that, hey, maybe you're just supposed to take care of me, and you're supposed to do this for me. And of course, we can contribute to that by an attitude where we feel uncomfortable or guilty or insecure about what we are doing and feel we should do more and more and more and more. And the more we do that, of course, the more we feed that in a kid, and the more they feel like, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. If Mom rushes around every time I get upset, or if Dad does everything I want when I start to cry, then what they're really telling me is that I'm kind of the center of things here, and I should be able to get or have whatever it is that I need. It often ends up something like this, especially in our society with Mother, although it's not related just to Mother, but when you think about a woman or a man, they're individual, they're individual, their wife, and their mother. Too often, in this situation, it looks something like this. In terms of role, and it really should be more like this. to put either parent in a situation where their primary responsibility is to their children is to create a situation that is inherently conflicted. Kids can be extremely tyrannical if encouraged to be so, or if allowed to be so.
What have you got down, right? I'm sorry,
I got. I've just got individual drawn very small, wife a little bit bigger, and then mother very large. From this notion of the focus that some kids sometimes expect that parents should have. Every once in a while, some parents will talk about the fact that I can't, in counseling, that we can't go anywhere. Well, why can't you go anywhere? Well, every time we go anywhere, the kids get upset if we want to go somewhere by ourselves. Well, when you have that kind of situation where parents feel they can't leave without taking their kids or can't do something without the kids, you have a situation much like this where the child may be running the show as opposed to the parents. Parenthood is a great responsibility, of course, demands enormous resources and enormous time and effort from parents, but to ignore one's individual needs or to ignore the relationship between husband and wife at the expense of the child is a very disastrous kind of situation. It often results then in real conflicts when the children grow up and leave, and the parents then are stuck with one another and haven't been working on the relationship in any way, but have devoted all their time to the children. And of course, some of those children then don't want to leave. Tyrannical children who are young often grow up to be tyrannical children who are old and who stay at home. And the tyrannical children who are old who stay at home can be very, very difficult to deal with. I was talking yesterday with a group about several situations where people will come into the office and talk about a 18, 19, 21, 22, 23, 24-year-old child who is a good word for these folks, who are still at home, who are extremely abusive, sometimes physically abusive to their parents, and the parents can't get rid of them. They can't get rid of them because they have in a sense created a monster that now they can't control. The child doesn't work. The child comes in at 3 or 4 in the morning. The child invites friends in for pot parties or alcohol parties in the basement and keeps the parents up all night, and yet parents feel helpless to do anything about that. That problem didn't start 3 months or 6 months before they came in for counseling. That problem started back in this kind of orientation where the focus is on the child and the child is to do everything, or the child is to be the focus of all the family's expectations. Recall, I don't know if you remember this, Pat, but we went to play tennis one time, and really, again, a very tragic sight. Here was this young man, about 24 years of age, playing tennis with his parents, who were clearly in their 60s. There were the three of them. It was a warm day, and this guy was working on his serve, had his parents on the other court, and he was rifling serves at them. And the parents were protesting, "Let's quit now, we're tired." "No, no, I want to work on the serve a little more." And he kept blasting these tennis balls at these elderly parents as if he were a 4 or 5-year-old child. And obviously the situation was clear that he had been the center of attention for years, and he still was. And he swore at them when they wouldn't hit the ball back. He ordered them around. "Come on, get those balls. Come on, I want to get some practice in." It was the most bizarre thing that I think I've ever seen. But really a product of that kind of situation. Okay, secondly then, that parents should, the second expectation, I'm sorry, the first one was that parents should, I've really been talking about the first one, which is that parents should dedicate their lives to their children. That's really what we've been talking about here. The next would be that parents should be perfect. As we started to say, that children expect perfection for a number of reasons, and we went over some of those. Parents expect children to be perfect. The media says that parents should be perfect. If you look on television at many of the shows, at least the shows I grew up with, you know, had these ideal parent situations, Donna Reed, Father Knows Best, all those things were, you know, these ideal families, Ozzie and Harriet, and situations like that. Many parents expect themselves to be perfect also because of the ideal parent literature. The notion that somehow if we read enough books that we ought to really be able to raise our children just right and in a way that the society expects of us. Ours has been called a psychological society. And the fact that I sit here and talk with you about child rearing is a function of that, in a sense that we've kind of turned over a lot of the responsibility for what is expected of us to psychologists, who are supposed to be the experts on how people are supposed to behave. And too many psychologists, of course, have different views about how to do that. And we go through periods of child rearing practices, and there have been many psychologists who have advocated that kind of thing. You know, that you should center your attention around your child. The child should be the focus of the attention of the family and to be given to. Not my expectation, not my belief, as you can see. And the third that I wanted to go to today is that the parents should be modern. Kids expect that the parents should be modern rather than old-fashioned. And they use those words, or words like that, modern in quotes. Well, what's a modern parent? A modern parent for most young people today is a parent who goes along with the things that that they want and the things that the other parents go along with. I don't know, again, if enough of you have children who are old enough to say these things to you, but kids come home and they say, well, everybody else is doing it, or Janie's mother says she can do it. I had an example one time. Our oldest daughter asked me, I think it was Halloween, and she said, can I go out tonight? And I said, yeah, that'd be okay for a little while, but don't be too late. She said, we're going to go in teepee houses. Can I do that? And my response to that was, no, you can't do that. I don't want you to teepee houses. That's not a nice thing to do, you know. And but she said, but everybody else is going to be doing it. You know, everyone else can be. All the other parents let their kids teepee houses. How come you won't? You won't let me teepee houses.
You better tell them what teepee houses means.
Anybody know what teepee in house is? Take toilet paper and you throw it. They throw it all over the trees and the houses. And you know, I guess it's kind of a harmless prank, but for uptight dad here, you know, it was really just too much. Especially when she asked me directly. I suppose we'd just gone out and done that. I wouldn't think it was so terrible. She said, "Can I do this?" The idea of I could see the headlines, you know, screaming, psychologist okays daughter teepeeing houses or something, you know, and the sirens and the stuff flashing. But our kids put a lot of pressure on us to do what and to give to them and to be for them what they want us to be. And it often takes a lot of strength and a lot of intestinal fortitude to be able to stick to our guns, even if we're not always completely sure of what it is that we should be doing. Kavanaugh talks about effective parents rather than modern parents. And by effective parents, he says, effective parents are those who realize it would be detrimental to rear their children according to the exact same principles by which they are raised, but realize it would be equally detrimental to be a modern parent, in quotes again, who doesn't have a sense of rightness and wrongness from their own perspective. That's what I don't remember. It's from a Marriage and Family thing, probably about 2 years ago. Effective parents are parents who feel that, who try to deal with their kids in a way that that allows for communication, that builds some kind of communication and cooperation, but that also holds out certain kinds of expectations that are not unrealistic, but more realistic. Kavanaugh says that kids need to feel that their parents truly care about them, but that not that they are desperate for them their children to like them. If we get into a situation where we feel like we have to be liked or loved by our children, we're going to be in a position where it might be very difficult for us to assert our own expectations. He also said that parents feel that children need to feel that their parents are strong and can't be manipulated around every issue that arises. They need to feel they need to develop frustration tolerance, not be given to whenever they want something, and they need to receive honest feedback and to learn to accept the consequences of their behavior. So I guess those were basically the ideas that I wanted to get out today, that expectations, both from us to our children and from our children to us, tend to get in the way in relationships between ourselves and our children, and that the unrealistic expectations are really the problem. I'm always struck by a recollection I have of seeing a movie called Fear Strikes Out, Jimmy Pearsall's story. And Jimmy Pearsall was a center fielder for the Boston Red Sox, and came out of a family where his father was a frustrated major leaguer and wanted his son very badly to be a successful baseball player. He was a successful baseball player. He was driven by his father to be that successful baseball player, and it resulted in a breakdown about 1 year after he came up from the minor leagues to the Boston Red Sox and was enjoying a very successful season. But in the movie, there's a point where Jimmy Pearsall is now playing with the Boston Red Sox, and he is this rookie right fielder who is doing quite well, but his father is upset because he's in right field instead of center field. And that's the kind of unrealistic expectation that can be very destructive to kids. And in the movie, Jimmy Pearsall hits a home run, and his father is sitting behind the screen, and he comes circling the bases in this frenzied run, and he touches home plate, and he runs up against the screen, and he grabs the screen, and he yells at his father, "Is that good enough for you? Is that good enough for you?" And at that point, he's kind of taken away, and actually did have a severe emotional break and was in the mental hospital for a couple of months, and eventually did recover and went on to play baseball and is now an announcer for the White Sox. But that kind of communication, that kind of unrealistic expectation is what can cause serious difficulties for all of us. But let me stop here and open it up to discussion a little bit, or comments or questions, and let's just talk about it for a while. Yeah?
I'm going to speak from a teacher's point of view. And the fact that it seems that there are a lot of books written for prenatal and babyhood, and then there's still some interest in up through 5 to 10, and then there seems to be a real cutoff and a real difficult time for parents and children after that sort of elementary age, when control becomes a real issue. And it's like parents all of a sudden just throw up their hands and say, "I don't know what to do. I can't talk to them. They won't listen to me." And then they come to school and they'll say, "Will you do something?" And I don't know what their whole background is, so each one is very different. But that 10 to 12 to 13 year old period is a really difficult.
Yes,
one.
It is. My feeling as a psychologist is that the most difficult kids to work with, from the point of view of education and from the point of view of psychological treatment, would be the age range. The junior high range, about 11 to 13 or 14. This is an extremely difficult period. They're neither fish nor fowl. They're no longer children, and they're not yet old enough as teenagers to deal with them from that point of view. and they don't communicate well, they don't want to talk, they are not psychological minded or education minded at all at that point. And very, very difficult age to deal with. That beginning adolescent age, or that transition period between childhood and adulthood, I think extremely difficult to deal with in the school setting and in the home setting and in the from the point of view of working with a psychological problem in the office.
What would be some resources of which you could get some sense of? I think that the problems are moving downward, you know, and
yes.
current information of how to deal with the pressures and the kind of things that that 12-year-old or 13-year-old now is dealing with, not what it was written 4 or 5 years ago,
yes.
but today.
Very true. Our culture is widening the adolescent period with many negative ramifications. It's not only lengthening in terms of the upper end, but dropping in terms of the lower end, so that we have kids now at 10 or 11 doing the kinds of things that 13 and 14-year-old kids did 10 years ago. Listening to the kind of music, wearing the kind of clothes, adopting the kinds of values, smoking the kind of dope often that kids at that age were experimenting with. So this is very frightening in many ways, but it's also perpetuated by our culture. You know, the most of the consumable goods, not most, but many of the consumable goods are geared toward that age range now, 9 or 10 to about 14 or 15. These are kids who are buying most of the records, most of the shirts, most of the clothes, most of the toys, most of the gadgets and fads of our society, that transition period. And of course, the money has to come from someplace. And then, of course, on the upper end, we now go to college, we go to graduate school, we go to professional training, and then we take a year or two off to kind of get our heads together, and all of that period of time becomes what we call extended adolescence. What Erickson called, an identity struggle. Who am I anyway? You know, how am I going to find out what I want to do? And the longer that goes on, the more that gives trouble to families, because when you're dealing with an adolescent beginning at age 11 or 12 up till age 19, 20, 21, or 22, you have a very long period of time. And I contend that that you don't know what stress is till you live with an adolescent. that there is no way in the healthiest situation that you can have an adolescent in the home and not have stress.
I think helping understand that they are going through a rebellious time, and for the parent to know when to back off and allow them to have some experiences, but not be afraid to say no at them. I think parents run into frustration and conflict when the child comes and asks you a question and they feel guilty about saying no to that person. It's okay to say no to your kid at that time. And I think if parents had more confidence in themselves and would say no to them when they felt it was wrong and harmful, and also give them some times when say yes to them too, but the least harmful things allow them to experience with. But don't be afraid to be backed in a corner to say no to your child at that time. And I think at that age, that's what happens to parents. That's what I can tell them what to do with this child, you know.
But if you say no all the time,
no,
if you say this is the way you're going to do, and you're going to do it the way I tell you to do, and you're going to do it without, you're going to do it when I tell you to
yes.
do it and how I tell you to do it, you're lost too, because what you're going to do is provoke a fight in every situation.
For instance, maybe I'd like to elaborate on that. For my own daughter, someone in church had come up to me and said, well, my daughter was 13 at the time, and she wanted to wear those high heels. You know, that they had out that made her look like she's 17 and she's only 30. And someone said, "My, how come you allow her to wear those shoes?" And I said, "At this point in time, that's the least of the evils that she's asking for." And I had to say yes, you know. So that's the way.
Yeah, good point. That what we, again, is a perfectionistic thing. We want them to be just right in every way. And we don't want to give in on any point. I don't want you to drink. I don't want you to smoke dope. I don't want you to go out with boys and stay out all night. I don't want you to wear high heel shoes. I don't want you to have pierced ears. I don't want you to have
and it becomes, I don't want. And you can't win all those battles. So you got to pick out the ones that are important, and you got to be able to give on some of the others. And it's, I think overhead says.
I know to put expectations on your children are a terrible burden that they really can't carry.
Unrealistic expectations.
Unrealistic. Yeah.
We all have expectations.
Well, yeah, that's the question. How do you get across these certain expectations without them becoming burdens, I guess? If we do have certain hopes for our children, but we don't want them to be burdens. I don't know if there's a way to do that or not. Maybe you shouldn't even voice them, just have these inner feelings.
Well, whether we voice them or not, they come through, I think. I think what we have to continually look at and examine in our relationship with our kids and in our family is, are we expecting something that that isn't reasonable or that is unrealistic? And we're constantly kind of shuffling through the deck and looking to see and hopefully throwing out some of those, if we can, that are the more unrealistic kinds of things that we want, the perfectionistic kinds of things, the things that say you have to be and I want you to be what I am and think the way I think. Those things won't work.
But probably the less specific you be in your expectations,
yeah,
the better, perhaps.
Nonverbal clues are more important. What you model is very important as opposed to what you say to those children. So there should be some consistency in what you want from them. You have to act some of those behaviors out. You can't just be talking them to them. And I think to a child, working with children, I find that the nonverbal clues are more important and more significant than what you say to a child.
I think this is a very good point, that we have to model the behaviors we want. Most kids will be the things that we are, just automatically, both good and bad, because the process of learning for young children and for children throughout the family development is one of modeling and identification, and that happens automatically, so that we have to be able to make sure that we're living the values that we're trying to transmit. And they will probably follow those. But it's those other models and some of the ones that we've learned along with that gets us into trouble, I think. I stopped somebody from talking over here.
Oh, I was just going to say about the high-heeled shoes. I find it difficult to find anything but high-heeled shoes for even 8 or 9-year-olds when you're getting into sandals. I mean, you were talking earlier about how they're selling to that age group, and they are. And
yeah.
They're making us conform to their ideas.
I got a question, and maybe just a concern, maybe there isn't even an answer, but when you're trying to relate, you know, cause and effect to a child, you know, like, this is what can happen if you do this, or this is what can happen if you pursue that. Maybe these have, you know, undertones with regard to sexual experimentation or smoking or doing whatever it may be. And I just would kind of question or ask if there's a way that you start handling at least the young adults when you can't show them empirically what the cause and effect is. You know, you can't say, now here, I want to show you so-and-so, and this is what happened when she did that. Is there kind of a reasonable and sensible way to get at that that problem, or at least at that dilemma?
Go ahead.
Well, my own feeling, my own reaction to your question, if I'm hearing it correctly, is that it's important that you help kids understand the consequences. It's important in the sense that you cannot be with your child at all times of the day. And they are going to experiment with some of these things. And say, for instance, drugs, you know, they have to even understand that even if they are in a group of children that are smoking, they're just as guilty. So you have to explain these things, talk to them.
But I think you're getting too. You have to let them experience some failure in those situations. We can't live it for them, and I think we tend to do this. I tend to try to do this, I think, as a parent, that I would love to be able to show my kids all the things all the pitfalls and not have them fall into the pits. And I know where I got it. My father did the same thing. He was a terrible hellraiser, and what he wanted to do was he had lived all that, so what he was going to do was going to keep me pure from all that. You know, that he was going to tell me all the things I shouldn't do because he'd done them and he found out they were bad. But, you know, it didn't work. You know, it worked for a while, But then I went out and did some of those things because I had to find out myself too. I think what we have to do is try to be, to stay in touch with our kids communication-wise so that we don't lose them as they stumble and as they fall and as they experiment with some of that. I don't think there's a kid today, probably of anybody in this room, who isn't going to experiment with, you know, alcohol, drugs, or sexual experimentation in some way. We just can't protect them from that. We would love to be able to say, don't do this, don't do that, you know, keep it this way. But we have to just, I think, understand that that's going to happen, look at our own lives and see what we experimented with, and be there to kind of show the consequence, help them up when they've fallen down, and kind of move them along.
I think, too, as the children grow up, it's really important as they are fighting to look for that identity, to have that home, a place to come, to know that they're still loved. Because kids have headaches as parents do, and problems and conflicts with, and even in their daily school, sometimes they'll have a bad day. Understand that. But that home has to be a place to know that no matter what happens in your life, there's somewhere, some place to go. And we have to close now. And there's kind of a parent's prayer that I'd like to pray with you, if you'd like. Oh, Heavenly Father, make me a better parent. Teach me to understand my children, to listen patiently to what they have to say, and to answer all their questions kindly. Keep me from interrupting them or contradicting them. Make me as courteous to them as I would have them to be to me. Forbid that I should ever laugh at their mistakes or resort to shame or ridicule when they displease me. May I never punish them for my own selfish satisfaction or to show my power. Let me not tempt my child to lie or steal, and guide me hour by hour that I may demonstrate by all I say and do that honesty produces happiness. Reduce, I pray, the meanness in me, and when I am out of sorts, help me, O Lord, to hold my tongue. May I ever be mindful that my children are children, and I should not expect of them the judgment of adults. Let me not rob them of the opportunity to wait on themselves and to make decisions. Bless me with the bigness to grant them all their reasonable requests and the courage to deny them privileges I know will do them harm. Make me fair and just and kind. And fit me, O Lord, to be loved and respected and imitated by my children. Amen.